Big businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you're listening today. Our producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. During this hour, we reach into the Focus 580 archives to bring you an interview with Benjamin Barber from September 21st, 2005, on his book Fear's Empire. As this is an archival recording, we can't take your phone calls during this hour. 10 years ago, an American political theorist named Benjamin Barber wrote a book entitled Jihad vs. McWorld. The book warned of a violent clash between the global spread of so-called democratic capitalism and the many traditional cultures being swamped in its wake. Aside from being a great read at the time and an international bestseller, 10 years later, the book looks prophetic. So today we're in the middle of a war on jihadist terror, or as seen by the jihadists, a global war on McWorld. In either case, we're living in what might be called Fear's Empire, which, conveniently enough, happens to be the title of Benjamin Barber's most recent book, Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy, published by W.W. Norton. The book resumes the story of Jihad versus McWorld following the U.S.-led war in Iraq. And in the book, Benjamin Barber considers the impact of the U.S. new preventive war doctrine on its stated aims, freedom, security, and democracy. And he proposes an alternative he calls preventive democracy. There's a lot packed in the book's 220 pages, and rather than making a vain attempt to summarize his ideas in this intro, we'll try to cover as much as we can with Benjamin Barber during this hour. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Benjamin Barber. He is a professor of civil society and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland and a principal of the Democracy Collaborative. He's also the driving force behind CivWorld, which is the Citizens Campaign for Democracy. Professor Barber is a consultant to political and civic leaders and NGOs in the United States and Europe, and his honors include a knighthood from the French government in 2001 and the John Dewey Award in 2003. He's the author of 17 books, including the international bestseller Jihad vs. McWorld, which, by the way, was updated in 2001. Also, his other books, A Passion for Democracy, A Place for Us, The Truth of Power, and Strong Democracy, among others. He also writes frequently for Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, The Nation, and many others. And there's much more we could add about Benjamin Barber by way of introduction, but we want to actually have time to talk to him during this hour. As we do that, we invite you into the conversation. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, if you're listening on the air or online anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Benjamin Barber joins us this morning by telephone. And good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks so much for being with us again. I want to spend most of our time exploring the ideas you present in your book, Fear's Empire, but to kick things off, 9/11 and the American response to it over the past 4 years seems to have put a fine point on your thesis in Jihad versus McWorld. Could I ask you to kind of give us a brief recap for those who haven't read the book?
I sure can. Let me also just say to your listeners in the air, I just was in at McComb in Western Illinois University a couple days ago.
Great.
And enjoyed being back in the Midwest, where my father actually was born in Mason City, Iowa. So I feel some. It's always a pleasure to be back in America's heartland, if only by telephone. But let me say about the theme of Jihad versus McWorld. I wrote that book because about 12, 14 years ago, I was noticing that there were two kinds of books being written. One was by people like Francis Fukuyama, who was saying history is over. The West is won. This was after the fall of communism. Mm-hmm. World capitalism was dominant. World democracy was dominant. There really was no more conflict, no more war. The world was coming together around global markets, global pop culture, around McDonald's and the World Bank, and everything was just hunky-dory. And then another set of books by people like Robert Kaplan, who had a book back then called To the Ends of the Earth, was saying, no, the world's not coming together around economic and pop cultural commonalities, it's falling apart. It's rupturing along tribal and ethnic and religious identities. And in fact, far from coming together, it was falling apart. And if you read the back pages of any newspaper, the financial pages, you say, no, it's coming together. But if you read the front pages with all the stories on the Balkans conflict, Rwanda genocide, the rupture of the nation state into ethnic tribal factions in many parts of the world, you said, no, no, it's falling apart. Looking at both of those trends, it struck me that both sides were right. The world was both coming together around economic and fiscal and pop cultural and global market concerns, but at the same time rupturing and dividing and falling apart around ethnic and religious and cultural boundaries. And that those two sets of forces, one disintegral and the other integral, were actually related to one another. And in Jihad versus McWorld, I gave the name McWorld to the forces of global economic and pop cultural integration, and the name Jihad as a just sort of general title to all the forces of religious reaction and ethnic disintegration. What was clear to me is that those two sets of forces were actually interacting with one another kind of dialectically, responses to one another, and that the collision of these two sets of forces, one integrating, the other disintegrating, was likely to be increasingly violent, increasingly full of conflict, and it was that, I guess, prophecy, that prediction, that then about 6 years later in New York and Washington in September 2001, the metaphor became reality.
Indeed. Well, and since then, you know, things, I think maybe Francis Fukuyama maybe has another book to write or something. But let's talk about Fear's Empire, turning to that, because there's a lot of very interesting ideas I want to try to explore. One of which is, you know, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, our initial response was this means war, obviously, and it was a war on terrorism. This is a very different kind of war than any other that certainly I'm aware of, and you know the adversary is a different type of adversary. In that it is not a national identity; it's not one place. It's sort of ephemeral, you know, groups of people who are, you know, loosely networked together, part of the sort of jihad mentality, perhaps, striking against, you know, the big McWorld. But really, the weapon of terrorism is fear more than anything. And it's a strategy of weakness rather than of strength, as you point out.
Well, that's right. And there are two, I mean, you really raised two very important points, and I appreciate the careful reading you've done of the book. I mean, one is that the new adversaries after 9/11 were not like the old adversaries. Traditionally, when nations are attacked, when there's a war, one nation state attacks another nation state. And, you know, from the 16th to the 20th centuries, all the great wars have essentially been wars between states. World War II was a war between, on the one hand, Japan, Germany, and their allies, and the Axis powers, in other words, and on the other hand, the allies, Britain, France, the United States, and so forth. And wars have been that way. The Franco-Prussian War was between the French and the Prussians. Even in the Korean War, it was the United States and its UN allies arrayed against North Korea with China sitting in the background. War is a feature of nation states. But in this new world of what I call interdependence, a world in which most of the forces that come at us are not forces inside of nations, but forces in the interstices between nations, those forces are interdependent. And what happened in 2001 is that we were, in effect, attacked by a malevolent NGO, a vicious non-governmental organization, which is how I describe al-Qaeda, not by a state. As a consequence, the government, when it responded in kind of 19th century terms, Bush looked for a state that to have attacked us. There had to be a state. That's the way traditional thinking went. He looked first to Afghanistan, where the Taliban had been sponsored and supported, and he took out the Taliban state of Afghanistan. And then when that failed to overcome al-Qaeda, he went to Iraq, which, of course, didn't have connections, but they at least were pretending it did. But the real mistake wasn't whether or not it had connections, but the fact that al-Qaeda was not a state, and we were attacking states, Afghanistan, then Iraq, and now some people say, well, how about Syria or maybe Iran? But al-Qaeda, being a non-state actor, simply fled the state under attack, much the way a parasite might crawl out of the belly of a slain beast in which it was inhabiting and move on to another. Al-Qaeda simply metastasized, fled, moved into other places, went down to Indonesia, went over to Africa, and indeed migrated migrated to places like Paris, London, and the United States. If you remember, right after 9/11, the president said any state that has harbored, even accidentally, has harbored terrorists is an enemy of ours. I was living in New Jersey at the time, and some of the terrorists had been harbored by the state of New Jersey, which might suggest the president wanted to make war on New Jersey, which is obviously absurd. But the real point is there was a deep asymmetry in a world of interdependence between our new enemies, diffused non-state actors that are terrorist organizations, really malevolent NGOs on the one hand, and our response, which was to deploy the military forces of a state against other states. So successful or not, whether you believe in the war in Iraq or not, what's very clear is that even if it ends up successful, it's unlikely to, but even if it does, little progress will have been made against al-Qaeda. Even had al-Qaeda been one of the groups being fostered by Saddam, and it wasn't, but even had it been, all it would have done is move on as it did in Afghanistan. So the fundamental policy of state-based military force going up against these new non-state actors simply can't work. And maybe I'll stop there for a minute and then come to your second point about fear, because that's the other side of the issue. But maybe we can stop for a minute with that long disquisition.
Well, none of that. That's very helpful. And I do want to, you know, sort of maybe reframe the second question about fear. I mean, you make the point that in many ways terrorism is an exercise in jiu-jitsu, because it really doesn't have military power. I mean, it can really do very little harm. I mean, yes, obviously real harm to people and you know, the World Trade Center, obviously. I mean, tragic incident and so forth, and it's, you know, physically harmful and emotionally to the psyche of the nation and so forth. But the real damage is the fear that instills in us.
No, that's right, Jack, and of course, the reality, I think it's sometimes hard to remember this, and I don't, as you say, I don't in any way mean any offense to those who lost loved ones, the people who lost their lives in terrorist events, whether in New York or in Morocco or in Spain or in London over the summer. Those are real and horrendous casualties, and, you know, the family members lost can't be replaced. But on the larger global scale, the fact is terrorists use those kinds of suicidal, horrendous methods because they have no other power. They don't have stock options. They don't have votes. They're not in a position to influence the world. Otherwise, they don't have armies. They don't have navies. They don't have an air force. They, in fact, start from a position of supreme weakness. And the only thing they have going for them is their capacity to instill fear and trembling in their enemies, which means, in a sense, their efficacy depends on us. They can only succeed if we allow ourselves to be made fearful. And I would argue that horrendous and destructive as the 9/11 attacks were in New York and Washington and on those four planes, really, in terms of the military, economic, and political might of the United States, it was like a flea on a grizzly bear. I mean, it didn't do anything. In fact, Katrina has been far more destructive to the American economy and dislocated far more people, and that's simply a natural disaster from which we will recover despite the incompetence of the response. So the reality is 9/11, for all its horror, was capable of inflicting long-term damage on the United States only if it could get us to be afraid. And I'm afraid, one has to say, partly as a result of the policies of the Bush administration, we were goaded into fear. And just to give you a couple examples, the color coding of the terrorist alert scale, you know, orange, yellow, up and down, that went on for years. In fact, there has not been another attack on the United States. But in terms of the fear levels and the money spent on preparations and Americans thinking, oh my gosh, the whole world has changed, nothing will ever be the same again, we have been goaded into a kind of fear in which they have gotten the reaction they wanted. If I'm Osama bin Laden, I would indeed sit in my cave in Pakistan and say my job is done. I don't have to attack them again because they're busy frightening themselves to death. We remember that in the fall after 9/11, there were people down in Atlanta in the suburbs wrapping their house in saran wrap to keep out supposed radiation that might come one day. There was money being spent in small towns of 50 and 100,000 for protection against possible terrorist attacks. All the money that's been spent on the airlines for what is mostly public relations kind of protections that are much more onerous on our own population than they're likely to catch any terrorists. All of that is a way of creating a climate of fear. And that fear has pervaded our politics and I think affected the outcome of elections. It's pervaded our civil rights, allowing this Patriot Act that encroaches on civil rights to be passed, even though there's no real evidence that it's going to make a serious difference. In effect, we have allowed 9/11 and terrorism to change our priorities, to change our approach to democracy and civil rights, to change our electoral politics, and to do all kinds of things that a free nation shouldn't be doing. And in this, terrorism succeeds, not because of it, but because of us.
We're talking this morning with Benjamin Barber, author of the book Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. And by the way, the book was published a couple of years ago, so you certainly can find it in libraries. It's also in the bookstores.
It's in paperback in the bookstores,
okay,
too, Jack.
Good, very good. Thanks for that. We have several calls to talk with and time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's include some callers. First up, someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. There's much I agree with about your analysis, but where I find it kind of gets derailed is when you apply it to the actions of the Bush administration in terms of attacking nation states. The real reason I think that we attacked or the Bush administration attacked Iraq didn't have anything to do with trying to stop terrorism. It had everything to do with building political capital to push through a political agenda, both domestic and foreign, through the Congress and past the people of the United States. And that was the real motivation. They knew all along there were no weapons of mass destruction and no real terrorist threat from Iraq.
You're probably right in that comment, but let me say, even if we give the Bush administration its due and pretend for a minute that its intentions were wholly honest and so on, let's do that for a minute. I agree with you. There are all sorts of cynical reasons that have to do with oil, with revenge, with Middle Eastern politics, and with domestic priorities that suggest why the lies were purveyed and why we went in. But let's, for a minute, just stop, playing that rather partisan, if nonetheless true, game, and say for a minute, okay, let's say for a minute the only reason they went in was really to deal with terrorism, and they did it in good faith, and that they were misled by information and so forth at the time. My point is, even at its very best, even giving the administration its best arguments, it's a failed and inefficacious way to deal with terrorism. And that's true not just in Iraq, where we all agree the whole thing is a disaster, but in Afghanistan, where mostly progressives and liberals as well as conservatives say we probably did the right thing. And while I have no particular critique of overthrowing the Taliban regime, my point is overthrowing a Taliban nation state did almost nothing to curb the non-state actor Al-Qaeda and now its many, many diffuse and decentralized offspring that it spawned in the last couple of years from continuing to operate in the world. And in that sense, as we move against states one after the other, we in effect are missing the real character of the new interdependent world in which we live. So that's my point. And while, people, I'm sure you'll find some Republican friends of yours who disagree with you about that and say, no, they went in goodwill, they were just mistaken. The point is, even if we give them their argument at its best, it's a failed argument.
Of course, the great irony is that now Afghanistan is producing more heroin than they were while the Taliban were in power. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to another Champaign listener on line number two. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
I largely agree with your analysis, but and I happen to be reading your book right now, as it happens, but I wonder if you could address my thought on the subject being that, to some extent, the paradigm you're talking about is sort of a reformulation of, like, the colonial era with Turkey, the Turkish Empire, and the Eastern Question, and how it broke up. And so these nation states are sort of a Western creation in a way, aren't they?
Well, that's a good point, and we don't want to confuse listeners with too many themes at the same time. But you're right. If you go back to the birth of the nation state is a relatively modern instrumentality. The Middle Ages, there was no nation state. There was a Holy Roman Empire and then a Roman Empire of the German nation and a Byzantine Empire and so forth. And empires contain many different peoples and nations, and the Germans would say Völker, Volk, das Volk, or the French would say peoples. And it was only in the 16th and 17th century that both larger entities broke down into nation-states, and smaller entities like Burgundy and Normandy and Provence and France joined up in a French nation-state, or if you read Shakespeare's historical dramas in which the various Dorset and Yorkshire joined into a England and eventually a United Kingdom. So the nation-state is itself a relatively modern creation, and for a while fairly stable. I mean, it had a pretty good history from about 1700 to the end of the Second World War. But by the end of the Second World War, Europe was recognizing that the nation-state was a cause of war, not a cause of peace, and the European nations were beginning to yield sovereignty to this new international entity that became the new Europe that has been growing until recently at a fairly fast clip. And other nation states were breaking down into their sub-national and cultural fragments and going to war with one another. So you're right, the whole question of the nation state is a difficult one. But the fact is, if you think about it, our political institutions, our laws, our military and economic policy throughout the world are organized around these three-century-old nation states, including our own. Around declarations of independence like our own, but all the realities we face, whether it's AIDS or ecological global warming or terrorism or global finance, are no longer focused on nation states. So to put it simply, we face challenges that have little to do with nation states and are interdependent. And as a remedy, as a treatment, we still are dealing with 19th century nation state institutions that are really ineffective in responding to them.
Can I pursue the point a bit?
Oh, go right ahead.
What I was thinking of was that we have two sort of supranational-like entities, like, say, Islam is a religion, which, at one reading anyway, doesn't really foster the nation-state. All the lands of Islam are held in common to some extent. You know, it's a commonality there. And then you have the supernatural state. You talk about, you use the term McWorld. So you have sort of one, you might say, modernism as opposed to, like, classicism, if you want to say that. What do you think about that kind?
Well, I think that's right. And there are, I mean, you're right. Religion, as it was in the Christian era with the Holy Roman Empire, and as it was in Byzantine Empire, and as it was in the Ottoman Empire, and as it is in pan-Islamic ideology today, does talk about a greater union than that of the state. And likewise, as you say, in my McDonald's and The Gap and MTV and CNN think of the world as one integrated market that they want to serve all of it. So in that sense, nation states have been left behind to some degree, both by the pop cultural and economic characteristics of an integrated world and by pan-Islamic feeling. Now, the reality doesn't always live up to that. As we know, Islam is divided from within. Nationalism is still powerful. Witness Egypt, witness Libya, witness Turkey, witness Iran, which have powerful... I mean, if you go to Iran, what you'll find there is a lot of people insist that they're not Arabs, they're Persians, that's different, and that their Persian quality and character makes them different than other Muslims in the Arab Middle East. You go to Iraq and you find that Kurdish and even Shiite and Sunni identity within Islam break Iraq down, and that Iraqi nationalism doesn't really work very well. So those forces, though they can be pan-Islamic, also tend to divide Islam and to divide the world from within, which again suggests that the world is both coming together around some global issues at the same time it's falling apart, sometimes around some of the same religious and cultural issues.
I want to pursue the idea of the tension between independence and interdependence a little bit with you, as you write about in the book. I mean, especially focusing on America, we've long placed a high value on America's independence, you know, thinking we can go it alone and succeed on our own terms. And it's very much a part of our natural mythology. In fact, you know, we have this American exceptionalism that says, you know, we're the greatest superpower in the history of the world, and especially in the last 3-4 years since 9/11, we have essentially said we don't need the United Nations, we don't need Europe, and we don't need these international kinds of agreements and organizations to deal with what we've decided to make our problem. What's wrong with that?
Well, again, as you describe it, that mythology of independence, which is there from our early Declaration of Independence, was an effective and powerful national mythology. And for a couple of hundred years, it was fairly descriptive of the reality. The fact is the two oceans protected us from most of the world. The fact is in the 19th century, we saw Europe's turmoil and its wars as distant from us. The fact is at the time of the founding, Washington and Jefferson and others warned against being messed up and engaged in the tumult of foreign wars and foreign politics, and we were really effectively independent, and even our economy was fairly independent. Trade with the world was only a small part of it. Our national issues of disease and so on, we had our own diseases to deal with, our own environment to deal with. All of that in the last 50 years has changed radically. When I was a kid, you know, I was dealing with issues of measles, maybe polio and so on, which were, in a sense, local diseases. Today we deal with SARS, with AIDS, with the new diseases coming out of the hot zones of Africa. And those spread around the globe in 4 to 8 weeks. There is no, even if we had a wonderful national health system that we don't, but even if we had one, we could not protect ourselves by virtue of that alone, because disease and public health are now global in character. Same thing with the large ecological disasters we face. Katrina proves that an administration that doesn't recognize global warming is in fact being affected by hurricanes of increasing force as a result of global warming. One of the predictors that suggests that global warming is an accurate theory is that it predicts that large storms will get worse, that both the extremes at the end of cold and hot will get worse, and these aggravated hurricanes we are encountering, and the same in with the typhoons in the Pacific, are the result of global warming. The fact is the ecological challenges we face can no longer be dealt with. For the first time in history, the United States actually accepted at least some help from abroad for a domestic natural disaster, not only because of the extraordinary incompetence of Washington and FEMA, but in the fact that also people were feeling, even the president was feeling, overwhelmed by this disaster because it's global in character. So the reality today is that interdependence characterizes the challenges we face, yet we still pursue this mythology of exceptionalism, independence. We don't need anyone else. We can solve problems by ourselves. But, you know, in Illinois, you haven't got a Western Illinois web. We have a worldwide web. The technologies are global. We don't have a Chicago Monetary Fund. We have an International Monetary Fund. We don't have a Missouri Trade Organization. We have a World Trade Organization. All of the forces that we face are global and interdependent in character. So the notion of continuing to respond to these global interdependent challenges with reference to independent nation states and their local constitutions just doesn't work. But, you know, we're not the only ones guilty of that. I mean, Iraq and Afghanistan are busy trying to establish independent constitutions and independent states. Yet almost immediately, and they're much weaker than we are, they will be thrust into a world of interdependence where their independence isn't really going to mean very much. The fact is Iraq's going to have to deal with Turkey, it's going to have to deal with Iran, it's going to have to deal with Syria and all of its neighbors, it's going to have to deal with Kurds, and it can't simply hide behind an independent constitution because those are challenges of interdependence. The United States, though it's hegemonic, though it's powerful, though it's the only great remaining superpower, is nonetheless subject to the very same challenges of interdependence, and even it can no longer survive pretending that it is an isolated, independent state surrounded by oceans and it can go its own way without worrying about what happens elsewhere in the world.
We're past our midpoint here with Benjamin Barber, author of the book Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy, also his book Jihad versus McWorld. You may be familiar with that, and many others. We have a couple callers waiting and time for others. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We have an Indiana caller waiting patiently on line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. Excellent show. Two questions. After 9/11, how should the government have reacted instead of the way it did? And now that it's reacted the way it did, how in the hell do we get out of it?
Well, thanks for those tough questions. I mean, the second one, of course, is the impossible one because, you know, we're dug into it. I'm certainly not somebody who thinks having created the situation that we've created in Iraq, we can simply walk away. Although at some point, I must say, you know, the quagmire is going to be such that, you know, no matter what we do, is going to cause a lot of damage, and maybe at some point we're going to have to walk away. But I haven't got an easy answer to that other than to say that what happens in Iraq, whether it succeeds or not, depends a lot on what help happens elsewhere in the Middle East and in the world. So maybe one way to treat with the kind of morass we're in and the fact that we can't stay and we can't leave and we got to figure out how to make the best of a very bad situation is to try to deal with some of the surrounding issues which might create a better climate for a settlement there. I mean, the ongoing anger and resentment between Shiites and Sunnis, for example, replicates problems that exist elsewhere in the Middle East, where United States monetary and economic policy might make a difference. But that is the hard question. But let me come back to the other question of what we might have done and what perhaps we still can do with respect to the war on terrorism. And what I would say there is that if you accept the premise that as we scare ourselves into panic and immobility and encroaching on our civil liberties and doing things that are really, in many ways, not appropriate for Americans to be doing, curtailing our civil liberties, closing down our borders, looking suspiciously at our fellow citizens and so forth, I mean, the answer is to assert our democratic civic engagement in the world, to act, as it were, with a fearless kind of civic engagement. After 9/11, there's a real irony. The people who were least frightened after 9/11 were those who should have been most frightened, the people at Ground Zero. Why? Because they were expressing their citizenship. They were actively engaged in rescue operations. Same with, of the four airplanes, the only citizens who probably died with some sense of fearlessness were those who rushed the cabin and brought down the airline over Pennsylvania instead of allowing it to go back and take out the White House or the Capitol in Washington. Why? Because, again, those people were not engaged in passive fear, in spectatorship, in watching people do things to them. They instead were engaged actively in trying to make a difference, trying to change the course of events on that airplane. And indeed, they did that successfully. In a word, the answer to passive fear is active citizenship, active engagement, doing something, making a difference. Bush had a little sense of that, because right after 9/11, you might remember for a brief period, he talked about getting community service up again, getting the Corporation for National Service running, getting people all to play a role. And most Americans after 9/11 didn't react with fear. They reacted with a sense of, how can we help? How can we make a difference? What can we do? Tell us what to do. And I think one of the worst things that happened after 9/11 was when the president said, don't do anything. Go back to shopping. Go back to the malls. Go back to your lives. We don't need to do anything. The government will take care of it. This is a little bit the same thing that's happening in New Orleans. Americans all over this country say, how can we help? What can we do? We'll pay more taxes if necessary and so on. The first thing the president says, don't worry. You don't have to pay anything more. No responsibility, no burden. We live in a country where Americans want to participate. They want to pay part of the price of making things right. They want to pay part of the price of making the country safe, and are being told again and again that they can go to the malls, they can enjoy themselves, there will be no reflection in their tax, there will be no reflection in service, there will be no reflection anyway, that they are, in effect, immune from taking responsibility. That doesn't make people feel good. I think in the long term it makes them feel passive, it turns them into spectators, and it actually increases their fear. So involving citizens in making the country work well and dealing with the problems of the world is a far better way than turning citizens into spectators who watch fearfully as the terrorist alert codes go up and down, as terrible events happen elsewhere in the world, and we, in effect, play a waiting game. When is it next going to happen to us? I think most Americans are, first of all, thinking, when is it going to happen next? When's the next shoe going to fall? Instead of thinking about what can we do to change the character of things, to deal with inequalities in the United States, to begin to make a difference in the world. So active citizenship is a great answer to passive fear.
Hope that gets the caller's question. We have several people waiting. We'll go next to a Kankakee listener in line, on line number one. Good morning.
Line one?
Yes, that's you.
A comment, and then your caller would wish to ask a question. The comment is that the term war is inappropriate when applied to terrorism, And when applied to the administration's recent overseas military adventures, the attack on the World Trade Center was a crime, albeit a very large crime. And the administration's actions have been and continue to be a series of even larger crimes in which the Congress acquiesces. But leaving that, the question, and the question perhaps restates a previous caller's question in wholly different terms. The question is, does the guest offer a prescription which those who are neither jihadist or McWorldist might pursue to overcome the excesses of each? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, it's nice to be in a radio station where actually there are members of the listening audience who are more radical than I am. Normally that doesn't happen, so I must say that caller is probably, would go even a little further than I would. I do agree that crime is probably a better word than war, but I understand, politically speaking, an attack like the kind that was launched on 9/11, it would be very difficult for a president or a politician to respond simply by saying, oh, well, a crime's been committed, we'll have the FBI investigate it. I mean, that was simply unrealistic given what happened. I also think I think we have to be careful with our hyperbole and our own rhetoric. I have great problems with this administration. I hope very much they will be voted out. I think they have misused the situation. I think they have made all kinds of terrible mistakes, and some of them have been cynical mistakes. But I think to suggest that they are responsible for crimes at the same level as, say, Al-Qaeda has been, is probably to go overboard and probably to lose most of the America that would like to support a reform effort and would like to change things, but is not probably willing, and rightly so, to say that basically Bush, there's no distance, there's no difference between Bush and Osama bin Laden. I myself just don't think that's true, and I think that kind of language probably doesn't help us in the long run to make the changes that we have to make. And that brings me to your second question, which is a terrific question, which is, how do we respond? How do we get out of the vicious cycle that takes us, on the one hand, to global markets and pop cultural triviality and the kind of trivialization of the world and the homogenization of the world around fast food and fast music and fast computers on the one hand, and then on the other hand, these kind of reactionary, jihadic assaults against the West and against modernity, which are equally destructive and equally unproductive in the long run. And in Jihad versus McWorld, what I argued again in Fears Empires, that in fact both Jihad and McWorld are at odds with democracy, understood. Democracy understood as engaged, ongoing civic participation. And what bothers me most about the United States right now is how many people use either their cynicism or their complacency to say, I just can't do anything about it, and then we engage in a kind of blame game. It's the Republicans' fault, it's the Supreme Court's fault, it's Bush's fault, and so on, and God knows they all deserve a lot of blame. But in the end, we are still a democracy. We do still have the right to participate in politics actively at the local and national levels, and I think we have to begin to remember that it is the success or failure of our country really finally depends on the quality and character of its citizens, not its leaders, who are only the people we choose. For better or worse, more of our fellow citizens voted for Mr. Bush than voted for Mr. Kerry. That wasn't the case 4 years earlier, but it was the case this time. We were outvoted, and if we don't like the results of that, then we've got to persuade our fellow citizens that they made a mistake, and that means engaging in and taking responsibility for and being active in politics and in civil society at every level. So that also has the virtue of overcoming our kind of passive fears about the world and giving us a sense that we make a difference. If I've been in a situation where I've been at the scene of a car accident, and the people who leave their spectatorship and enter into rescue efforts, get somebody out of a car, give them mouth-to-mouth respiration, and are helping out, their fear, that terrible fear in the pit of your stomach, goes away. Those who just watch grow even more fearful, more anxious, and more passive. So I think here, taking some civic responsibility for these issues, getting engaged, finding ways to make a difference, maybe not in national politics, but in ways that change the character of local politics. I mean, people in Missouri and Indiana and Illinois, downstate Illinois, rural Illinois, are part, after all, of red state America that voted, maybe in good faith, but voted for Bush. That means a lot of the fellow citizens of people in the listening area voted the other way. I mean, what are you doing to persuade them to change their mind? I think calling Bush a criminal worse than Osama bin Laden probably isn't going to be a very useful way to persuade them to change their vote. But maybe an argument about Bush, even at its best, misunderstanding the character of the world we live in and not really being up to the challenge of an interdependent world, is a better way to get people engaged and get them to see that they've got to change. They've got to change how they vote.
We have a couple calls waiting, but I have to ask a follow-up question because I think it gets at the core of certainly the book Fear's Empire and other of your works. You write a lot about democracy, and I guess I wonder, we talk as a country a lot about democracy, and we say, in fact, that we are attempting to spread democracy, especially in the Middle East right now. But I just wonder if we even, when we say that, do we really know what it is, what democracy is?
Well, that's a good question. And not only do we know what it is, but do we practice it? Even if we do know it is, do we practice what we think we know? And the answer in both cases is we don't know it as well as we should. And part of Fear's Empire actually is an attempt to deal with what it means for countries elsewhere to democratize. And the first thing we can say is you can't do it by force, by invasion. And the second thing you can say is to be democratic doesn't mean to be American. There are lots of different ways towards democracy, lots of different roads to self-government in Western Europe and in North America. We've seen many, many different ways of even doing it, even in the original 13 colonies. Compare Massachusetts with Virginia, two completely different ways of approaching democracy. So, first of all, we have to understand it better. But second of all, it might help if we concentrated a little on making it work better in the United States. I think everyone, even conservatives and Republicans, recognize that Katrina and what happened in New Orleans tore the mask off of deep-seated inequalities, economic inequalities, racial inequalities, generational inequalities. I mean, all the victims were people of color, people of age, people who are not part of that large middle class that we think defines America. And until we deal with the inequalities inside the United States, it's going to be very hard to make anyone else think that we are fit representatives for speaking about democracy elsewhere in the world. So I think those twin things, understanding that democracy is a slow, long process that is achieved in many different ways in many different places, and you don't have to be American or Americanizing to do it, and focusing on making our own democracy work more effectively, getting more than 50-51% of the population to actually participate in elections, and dealing with these fundamental economic and racial inequalities that we still suffer from, would be a terrific way to make the model of democracy we're trying to sell to the world more viable and more influential.
Well, and perhaps I'm engaging in cynicism myself here, but it seems a lot of times that Americans think democracy is composed of two things: elections and free markets. But
well, you're right, and again, let's say first of all, even within the political side, democracy is far more than elections. Elections is the tip of an iceberg. Elections are only meaningful if citizens are informed, if they're engaged on a regular basis, if they participate in deliberation, if they participate in jury duty, and I would argue, by the way, if they participate in national service and military duty. I mean, to have wars fought by a tiny minority of Americans, often from less fortunate economic classes, while the rest sit around, is a disastrous way to run a democracy. One reason we finally got out of Vietnam is that the army was a conscript army that affected every part of society back then. So in general, democracy has to mean a lot more than just voting. And second of all, free markets, capitalism, and democracy are two different systems. They are synergistic, they work together rather well, but to think that because you have a market society and an effective capitalism, you have democracy is just absurd. We need only look at the most productive, fast-growing capitalist society in the world, communist China, to know that you can have capitalism operating in a system that is wholly undemocratic. And we saw that in the 1970s in places like Chile, in Latin America, and so forth. So democracy and capitalism are not the same thing, and while democracy serves capitalism, and to a point capitalism may serve democracy, they're two different systems, and when you get capitalism and free markets, it doesn't mean you have the other.
We have a couple callers and about less than 10 minutes left in this hour, Focus 580. We'll go on and include a listener in Bloomington, Indiana. Next, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi, I didn't hear the first part of your program, but may I make a few points in favor of the democratization of Iraq? You know, if we can establish a democratic base of freedom and prosperity in the middle of the terrorist home territory, we have virtually won the war on terror, and we are already seeing the payoff. We have seen Syria remove her troops from Lebanon. We have seen elections in Egypt. We have seen Libya give up the development of nuclear weapons, and recently there have been very few bombings in Israel. Israel has actually been calm. And I think maybe most telling of all is the focus of al-Qaeda on Iraq. The amount of al-Qaeda must feel very threatened by the democratization of Iraq, because they have been willing to spend huge amounts of effort and blood. And it's interesting to note the pattern of their terror. They intensify their terror just prior to any democratic expression. You remember, just prior to the elections in Iraq, they intensified their terror.
Now, I have to say, I'm sorry you didn't hear the first part of the discussion, because the first part of the discussion gave an interpretation of the way in which reacted to terrorism through fear and through invading nation states that tried to suggest that was going to be a ultimately ineffective policy. But I won't try to rehearse that, because most listeners have heard it. But just take, I mean, yes, democratization in Iraq would be a great thing. If you see signs of stability and democratization in Iraq, you're doing a lot better than I am. I see signs of a coming civil war. I see America approaching 2,000 casualties with no end in sight. I see Iraqi civilians, particularly Shiite civilians, now numbering probably about 100,000 dead and probably 200,000 or 300,000 wounded. I see a destabilizing society. I see a society in which none of the indicators of a good life, whether it's the availability of electricity or plumbing or the effective pumping of oil, has begun to come up to where it was supposed to be. And I see a situation that is deeply, deeply unstable. I would predict that what you're going to see in Iraq over the next year is not democracy, but civil war. And I'm afraid that's likely to be the outcome. I completely agree with you that were we able to, and would Iraq actually be able to successfully establish a democracy, that would sure help the world and help stability there. But to say that al-Qaeda is suffering, I think really begs imagination. The fact is, al-Qaeda is doing tremendously well. They're striking all over the world. They're striking fear into the hearts of many people. And the reason they're in Iraq is that we turned Iraq into it was a horrible, despotic state, but one utterly without terrorists, because the terrorists couldn't operate in the face of a totalitarian dictator like Saddam, who made quick work of anyone who tried to go outside his version of the law. Whereas today, we've created a model situation for recruiting terrorists from all over the world, and they're just dying, literally, to come and fight there, to take on Americans, to get involved in the war. We've actually created a theater of terrorism as a result of our invasion that wasn't there before. So I'm afraid, from my point of view, Iraq is nothing but a bad example of all the wrong decisions we've been making since 9/11.
Well, because of the caller's point, we'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 2. Good morning. Hello? Is there a listener there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to comment on the relationship between liberalism and globalism. But first, I wanted to say that we already have a global power structure in place in this world. You know, you have the G7, the G8, actually, and the World Bank, and these structures do wield a lot of power and global influence. But I wanted to make a connection between liberalism and globalism. It seems that liberal policies are aimed at promoting interdependence and globalism and a global power structure. If you just look at things such as zero population growth, the abortion, and that type of thing, which make nations such as in Europe and the United States dependent upon immigration, and then multiculturalism, which inhibits the assimilation of, you know, immigrant groups into a culture. And, you know, even environmentalism, which, you know, makes a country like the U.S. dependent on foreign sources of energy by such things as limiting nuclear power, which makes us more dependent on fossil fuels, which makes us more prone to global warming. And it just seems to me that liberalism, the liberal political structure, is actually a tool of globalism. And that's why you see the super rich, such as Gates and Rockefellers and Soros, why they all support heavily support liberalism and liberal candidates.
Well, that's a very interesting point, and I agree with you in a limited way in that most ideological positions have dialectical, which is to say oppositional outcomes, in many cases different than that that one might expect. And I certainly agree with you that there are some unintended consequences of liberal positions, just as there are unintended consequences of conservative positions that liberals themselves would probably not be very happy with and would at least pretend to disown. Those are complicated questions and, you know, ones that we need. I mean, I would ask a question to your question, though. I think that kind of a debate, the questions you raise, which are thoughtful and dialectical and worthy of discussion, in some cases I would agree, in some cases I wouldn't, but we live in a society right now dominated by a media that makes that kind of debate impossible. Because what you've done is you've in a sense taken it home to the liberals and say, look, the liberals seem not to live up to their own ends if you look at the consequences of some of the policies they embrace. That's a really thoughtful and interesting debate, but one we cannot have in America, because to have that kind of a debate on talk television or talk radio would just be out of the question. It doesn't parse easily into you're on the right, you're on the left, you're on this side, you're on that side. And one of the problems we have with making democracy work is having the kind of debates that over the last hour Jack Brighton has made possible with his show and that we sometimes get on public radio, but on the mass media that are watched by 95% of the country that never listen to public radio, we simply don't have an opportunity for that kind of thoughtful debate. And that makes it very hard to have the deliberative discussions that we need to get to the root of these issues.
We just literally have about 2.5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the concept of lex humana and the Declaration of Interdependence. It seems to me that a lot of the changes that we need to make in terms of democracy and being able to live and share this planet together have to do with personal sorts of commitments to.
Well, that's a great question to end with. And about 3 years ago, a group of people from 20-25 nations came together and agreed that we would celebrate every September 12th. The day after September 11th, a day of interdependence, a day dedicated to raising consciousness about the realities of interdependence, the challenges of interdependence, and the needs to create forms of constructive interdependence to deal with them. And this year, I just got back from Paris, where with the mayor of Paris and representatives of civil organizations from 20 or 30 countries, we had Interdependence Day. Last year we did it in Rome with the Catholic Church and the mayor of Rome, a socialist mayor of Rome, and the Pope, at that point John Paul, participating. The year before it was in Philadelphia, next year in Morocco. We do this Interdependence Day, and you can learn more about it on the site called civworld.org, civworld.org, or benjaminbarber.org, either one of those. But we are trying, we also have a civic interdependence curriculum that's in some New York and Philadelphia schools, and we're working to expand that. So those are ways in which I'm trying to put flesh on the bones of the idea of interdependence to get people a sense that these are simply realities we have to deal with. If American citizens don't get it, they're not going to elect politicians who get it. And right now, politicians are the last in the world to figure out that we live in an interdependent world, and being American, nice as it is, simply isn't enough.
Well, we'll have to leave it there since we're out of time. Our guest, Benjamin Barber, the book we've been discussing, Fears, Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy, published by W.W. Norton, and you should be able to find it in libraries, and also a paperback edition should be in bookstores as well. Another book you might recognize, Jihad versus McWorld, both great books. And to you, Benjamin Barber, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Jack. Thanks a lot.
And that was an archival presentation of an interview that aired on September 21st, 2005, with Benjamin Barber. That and many other archives on our website, will.uiuc.edu.
Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Ross and Joanne Butzo in honor of their granddaughter, Zoe Butzo, on her fifth birthday.
That's it for this hour of Focus 580. In just about 10 minutes, we'll be back with another archive, an interview with technology writer Bruce Abramson about his book, Digital Phoenix, Why the Information Economy Collapsed and Why It Will Rise Again. First, we'll take a break for some news and a market update.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandAgriEnergy.com.
It's 10:59. I'm Tom Rogers with this market update. Soybeans have turned down in Chicago on the Board of Trade after opening up. Corn wheat still up on the day, though. September in Kansas City wheat is $4.88 a bushel, up 4 cents. September in Chicago at $3.93, up 4.5. December wheat on the Board of Trade, $4.13.5, up 5.5. September corn is at $2.37.75, up 0.5. December, $2.54.5, up 1. March corn is at $2.68.